Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
With some of the high-end stuff, I was talking to someone, I think it was at Singer, and they were saying one of their customers got to the end and then said, I enjoyed this process so much, like I'm a bit sad that it's come to an end. I've got a car, but like I enjoyed this, like whatever it was, year and a half process of all the speccing and stuff. Like I'd just like to do it again and ordered another one.
That's madness, right? Yeah, and it's quite common. You know, particularly the custom bespoke or resto mods, they really like the process. And so, you know, someone will be engineers at heart. They've got their day jobs to build big companies, etc. And then they get that and a hash of here's your photos and videos throughout the week of what now with where your money's going into these machines and these machines come into life. And they love it. So that's consistent feedback we get is that the clients of our clients absolutely love seeing their updates.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Car Chat podcast. I'm Sam Moores and I'm here with Rowan Hick. Hello.
Hi.
Welcome. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about sort of who you are, what you do?
Yeah, so Rowan, I'm the founder of Global Workshop, which is a vehicle build management platform for people who build and restore and race awesome machines around the world.
Yeah, okay. So the way this came about, this podcast, and it's, I feel like I'm trying to do something slightly different to my normal ones, because Rowan got in touch with me and said, oh, like our software was mentioned on another one of your podcasts. And I was like, oh, I didn't like, and I think I asked the guy, like, tell me a bit more about this, because I don't know anything about this software, this stuff, and what it is. So I was a bit interested. And we decided, you know, why not? Let's have a little chat, little podcast, and delve into this topic a little bit, and then also have a bit of chat about cars and whatnot. So how did this kind of, your background, what's your background before you started this project? And this has been quite a long project, hasn't it?
Yeah. So the project itself has been about 10, 11 years now in the making. So my background is professional software development. I'm before bringing Global Workshop out, I was in the window and door software industry of all things. Every building has windows and doors in it, and you need software to make it. Nobody thinks about it, but they're incredibly complex things to manufacture. And I was living in Canada at the time, and I was wanting to move home to New Zealand, and I always wanted a Lotus 7 type machine. And one produced in New Zealand is called the Fraser. And went ahead and purchased it, or purchased the process, and yeah. started getting my first build reports and thought, I could do something better about this. So.
I've done a little bit of, you know, I've had even just basically you send your car in for a service. And I don't know, when I first did that, probably when I was like 23 or something like that, was the first car getting serviced and whatnot. And just endlessly amazed that like there was never any photos, never anything, never any detail. Was this where you were like, hang on?
Yeah. And not that the company was doing anything wrong. They were keeping me informed, but I'd just get like, an email and here's a couple of photos. And of course, I'm not there. So you want to see everything, right? There's a lot of people who are getting these cars built or restored. And for them, that process is almost as important as the end destination, right? Because they're all running companies and they're earning lots of money. And really, it's these hobbies on the side that they're pumping all that money into. And so... You know, they can often not see something for months and months at a time. And it's not that the shops are doing anything wrong. It's just they haven't had the tools or platform to enable them to easily record and capture that progress for people. So that's where it started from.
Yeah, because you see, I've come across lots of books made by someone doing a restoration or whatever. And the... Everything I can gather is the customers value that like so highly because it's some documentation. I've sort of come up in the internet world, I guess, of pics or it didn't happen, and that like that sort of still sticks with me massively. That like if someone, I don't know, I had an issue with some clutch stuff after I've having a clutch change, and I was like, can you just send me some photos of like what you took out and what you put in? And they're like, oh yeah, we didn't take any.
Yeah. Because it's all done. They forget about it. And then.
Yeah, which is fair.
Yeah.
But me as the customer was always like, okay, but what was it like? Did you actually do it? Like, is there anything?
And then you get your £10,000 invoice at the end of the month of all this work that's happened. And there's a tremendous amount of work that's happened over that month. And then you might get a handful of photos if you're lucky.
So you started speccing this Fraser. I've not come across them. But it's like a sort of Caterham 7 type situation. And you get these photos. And how did that next bit where you went, okay, this could be done better. Did you go to the people building your car or did you just start making something?
Yeah, so first of all, I looked around and just said, okay, well, surely there must be some software to manage the process because the inherent, somebody's got to take the pictures in the shop and then take them off the camera and put them on the file server and then resize them, email them off to a customer. So the steps in the process are quite laborious for a workshop, particularly if they're going to do a lot of photos and videos, particularly videos, like that's just next level for a lot of workshops. So looked around, there was no software. So I'm like, right, I'll build something. So built the first prototype and gave it to Fraser. So I'm saying, hey, try this out, see what you think. And sure enough, they started sending me reports through on Leica using the platform and then started putting it on all of their customers, which was amazing. So,
yeah. And did that have what, at that point in time, what sort of functionality did it have?
So it was, I don't think at that point, originally we had a mobile app. It was just a web browser-based thing. So it could drop the photos on, it would resize them, put it into a visual timeline of the car. It would email me saying, hey, here's your update for today, and then you log in and see your visual timeline of that car coming to life. So it was quite cool. So I'd be driving home usually it was Thursday on my way home from work in Toronto, and I'd get my little update reports in the car. Nice. Oh, come on, traffic, stop. so I can see my pictures before I get home, because you want to see them straight away, right? It's really exciting. Yeah. Like, you know, hey, what's happened this week? And the supercharger's been put the mounts together for the supercharger. Okay, here's what's going on this week. And so, yeah. So at the end of the month, you go, okay, all right, I know what the money was for. Here you go, invoice paid. That's, don't have to
and
ask
I've
question.
Had a bunch of like entertainment out of the process in the middle.
Exactly. Exactly.
Like that. I've come across with some, it must happen at all levels, but with some of the high-end stuff, I was talking to someone, I think it was at Singer, and they were saying one of their customers got, got to the end. I think he'd ordered like a DLS or something, and then said, I enjoyed this process so much. Like, I'm a bit sad that it's come to an end. I've got a car. But like I enjoyed this like whatever it was year and a half process of all the specking and stuff. Like I'd just like to do it again, and ordered another one.
That's madness, right? Yeah, and it's quite common. You know, particularly the custom bespoke or resto mods, they really like the process. And so, you know, someone will be engineers at heart. They've got their day jobs to build big companies, etc. And then they get that. And a pitch of here's your photos and videos throughout the week of what now with where your money's going into these machines and these machines come into life and they love it. So that's consistent feedback we get is that the clients of our clients absolutely love seeing their updates.
Yeah. Yeah. I would love like literally everyone I use for anything that builds anything for me to or works on just to like have something that's I presume it's quite easy. Like, I know it's evolved a lot, and you say now there's an app and that, so I presume that was quite a big step.
We're so far ahead of where we first started, sort of. The media side of the platform is quite mature now, so all the guys, girls in the shop working on the cars, they'll all have an app, which they can record the progress as they're going. And workflow tools, so the shop manager can go, okay, well, these ones will go off to the client and these ones will keep in-house and these ones we delete and I care about them anymore. So there's the workflow management side of that media, handling video uploads, guest passes. So the person who's getting the car built, they'll have their friends and family that also might be interested, right? Yeah. So we can hand out guest passes to their private car builds. So their mates can follow along with the build as well, which just gives the workshops kind of free word of mouth advertising as well.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. And what sort of, how has this evolved over time? Presumably the app's got more trick and stuff like that, but in terms of features, like has a lot of it been your client led in terms of they go, this was really great, but we need this. Can you give me some examples of those sorts of things?
Yeah, so really what started the ball rolling on expanding the platform and what it does was Cal CBR RetroPower. So he'd started using the platform. He was, and we've been growing by word of mouth. So Simon Lord over at Redux said, hey, to RetroPower, hey, you guys should use this. And so they picked it up. They started using it and they really loved the client communication piece. He said, right, in this industry, there is no good solutions for inventory management. So tracking all the consumables that go on in the build, because they use a lot of stuff all day and it's not planned necessarily, right? Like, you know, at a high level, you're going to use welding rods and sanding discs and all these nuts, bolts and washers. But the tracking of those individual consumables is quite time consuming, and shops today have been using things like job cards or a central PC. They go up and note everything down, and it's been quite clunky. So twisted my arm, and I knew as soon as we were going to do it, it would set the ball rolling on the rest of it. So started that, rolled that out, and then it just took off from there. So we found out, well, naturally it was like, okay, well, time tracking's next and job task management around that.
Okay.
Some pretty interesting stuff in the pipeline as well. So
interesting. So it's become much more of like a back-end team build management tool alongside the sort of fancy front end that the client sees?
Yeah, well, it's sort of like we built it backwards in that we started with the client experience first, which a lot of systems out there in other industries, this kind of client experience is the last thing they think about. And consequently, it's usually the worst thing that's done. So we started with, okay, well, the client has an app and the client has, you know, here's the thing coming to life. So the client's all happy. And then discovered that really in the bespoke world, because traditional garages and dealers, there's a whole bunch of software out there. There's all sorts of garage management solutions and dealer management solutions, but they all tend to fall over in the bespoke world because the builds are so long running. There's hundreds of thousands of hours going into builds and thousands of parts. And even things like just, you know, you'll be invoicing for potentially a couple of months at a time of work. And some systems don't even allow you to invoice across a month. You have to close off a job and then start a new job for next month, which the workshops are good. They hate it. Well, your invoicing can only handle so many lines written out on an invoice, which, you know, a month's work for, say, five guys on a car, that's a tremendous amount of things that have been done.
Yeah.
So we found this whole hole in the industry quite by accident. Good luck.
Oh, interesting. And has it been used just by, you say, bespoke products, but I guess it's not, it started as cars. Has it been taken on by, I guess it could be used by all sorts.
Yeah, so we now have a couple of boat builders on the platform, and even the one that I'm really proud of, this we've got Warbird Restoration Company. So Warbird. Warbirds.
Yeah.
Wow. So, which is incredible. But it's all the same processes as a car restoration, just on a slightly longer time scale.
And do they have significantly more components and parts and time?
They'll significantly more time. And an airframe, like, say, if you're to detail out, I think a P51 Mustang has 44,000 individually serialized parts on it, not including rivets. So we haven't got to planning and building an airframe yet. I don't know if we'll get to that point. We certainly have got restoration as a client on the platform of the T40 Kitty Hawk, which is pretty fantastic. And the history behind those planes is just incredible.
And so they just have, like, if say you opened up the project on one of those, do they just have like whatever it was, 40,000 parts like listed and scanned in?
Yeah, on those ones, no, not at the moment. They'll have a kind of a history of what the, eventually actually over time, as they're scanning and documenting the parts, eventually that would build up over time. So, hey, scanned in so many rivets and scanned in so many sanding discs, etc. And, you know, the time that's going into the, it's all, okay, Warbirds is time. It's a lot of time because they'll, you know, pull a piece off. They can only use the original piece, at least under CAA rules here, is no more than 10% of it has been eroded away over time from corrosion, etc. So if, you know, more than 10% of the thickness is gone, then throw it out and make a new one, right? And so there'll be a lot of metal and then a lot of hours to make it.
I went to the, there's an RAF museum in London. I went with my toddler today because he likes planes. And like sitting under some of these things, you're like, oh, well, yeah, I could see there'd be quite a lot of work in putting one of these back together and getting it get flying and all that, all the various processes and whatnot.
And they're arguably, the restorations today are arguably better than what came out of the factory. Because the factory at the time, they were pumping them out for the wall, right? So just get them out as fast as humanly possible. And now it's okay, it's just detail, making everything perfect on the airframe.
So with this this Fraser you had built, did you get to choose a lot of the options on it, and what did you go for?
Oh, yes, right. They are, they do a wide variety of things. So they've got a couple of standard engine packages that people usually use. So your typical 4AG, 3SG. And I'd driven the demo one. It wasn't enough for me. so we went backwards and forwards and settled on a supercharged Honda K20A, which went slightly overboard.
So what sort of power does that put out?
So now it puts out 400 at the crank, 400 horsepower at the crank, so 350, 350 at the wheels.
Okay.
Yep.
And weighs half a ton?
Yeah, it's a 670 kilos with all the tools, everything on board, like corner weighted, so that's around 600 horsepower per ton.
And are you on a sequential gearbox at that point?
No, that was the one thing I think my wallet enclosed by about that time. So we went for a standard 5-speed box. So if I could do it all again, I probably would have stretched the wallet to the sequential. So that's probably the only thing that's a little bit of a letdown on the car. It's just the time between changing gears.
And what do you use this car for?
Going to the shops. we used to live up in Auckland, New Zealand, which was close to quite a few racetracks. So we'd go out and do track days and all that fun stuff. And then we moved to a couple of years ago, top of the South Island of New Zealand. There isn't a racetrack close by. So and now I've got the startup to build. So it's in the garage. And then once the startup's, it's a little bit more settled down, then it will go out for track days again.
I bet that is a lot of fun. A friend of mine had a 620R, which must be similar sort of pace, I guess. And he had a lot of problems with overheating, as in not the car overheating, but his feet overheating. Do your feet get hot?
No, because Yang was slightly bespoke, you learn from other people's car builds of what they've done. So a friend of mine had one with an F20 engine, which had the exhaust kind of in the same pedal box area, but it came down and out in front of your feet. So there was a lot of heat coming off the exhaust. Yeah. So instead, we're basically from the exhaust ports went straight out the side of the bonnet, away from the feet and down, and wrapped it. And so we actually don't get a lot of heat off the exhaust. Like, sure, on a track day with banging down the back straight, there's a bit of heat coming off there, but round town, it's actually quite good. So
yeah, no, he was complaining that his feet were melting.
Yeah, you do have to put a lot of insulation in and wrapping around it.
Yeah. That makes sense.
No, they did. Fraser's did an amazing job on the car. It's basically a pussycat around town, off the throttle. It doesn't have any overheating issues.
What made you choose a Fraser? And had you been through a bit of a sports car journey before that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So I've loved cars since I was a kid. I grew up and watching the Group B and Formula One turbo era. So got a thing for engines with forced induction, and had the first real car was a Nissan Silvia turbo, and then I think it was 20 at the time, and got a, no, 19, got a 300 ZX twin turbo, the Z32, and of course modified it. New Zealand has a big JDM car scene, so everybody around that time was getting the R32s and 300s and Supras and RX-7s, and sort of the boy racer scene back then was the proper max power scene, right? So
is that now massive, as like massive now in New Zealand, like JDM scene?
JDM scene has been persistently huge. There's a lot more rules and regulations now. It's a lot harder to modify vehicles. You have to modifications. You do have to get certified, so you can't just You can sometimes. So we have the equivalent of an MOT, so a warrant of fitness.
Yeah.
And so sometimes they don't quite know what they're looking at, and other times it's like, oh no, that's not standard. Off for a cert you go. And then that,
right.
And then, yes, you know, so you can't go and whack a big single turbo on something and not get your suspension and brakes sorted out. They want you to make sure that the...
So it's more like a this is safe test. Okay. So like your car, for example, someone's gone that safe.
Yes. Yes. It might kill you. Well, everything's safe on the car. Whether you know you'll kill yourself is up to you.
It's all bolted on.
Yeah, the cert processes, and it changes like every over time as things have happened. I remember one person launched a car at a drag strip, pretzeled the drive shaft. Didn't hurt himself too badly, but it was right beside his hip. And that forced a new rule change of his drive shaft hoops came in after that rule change, even though that had happened on the drag strip, not on the public road.
Yeah.
It still, I think, gave the certification body pause to go, actually, maybe we should be making sure on these high-power cars those drive shaft hoops are there. So.
That is interesting, because you would think you'd just go, yeah, but it wasn't on the street, was it? I guess... They go, but you were driving that on the street. It could have done it.
Yep. And there's some monster horsepower cars driving around on the road. So that's.
Do you have funny tax rules, or is it like moderately okay to buy stuff, like in terms of import tax and stuff like that?
It's pretty easy. So there's GST. So we have our equivalent of VAT, which is GST.
Yeah.
GST. So you have a GST on import. There'll be a few duties, but nothing too horrendous. It's really just the certification of bringing a car in. So depending on what that car was, so if you bought in a Porsche Cayman, it would pretty much fly through the first certification import. If you brought in, example, an Ariel Atom, I think there's some of the suspension components need to be changed because they won't comply with our laws here. So a company will go and change those components and then it gets certified and then it'll comply. And if you bring in something really old, then all sorts of things need to be changed. Yeah. So.
Okay. But you don't get the Australian like massive import duties and stuff like that?
No.
That is quite nice. I've spent some time in the South Island. I was a ski instructor at one point, and I lived in Wanaka during the summer for like 2 years. Summer here, winter there. I've always wanted to go back with a cool car and drive some of the roads. We had this like Subaru Estate from 1987, something like that. And I've seen, because there's a few race events. I can't remember what it's called. Is it like a Targa something?
Yeah, the Targa New Zealand. There's a Targa Tour and Targa New Zealand. I've always wanted to do that. So again, once we start.
Is that like a race on streets, or is it not quite that?
Yeah, it is a race.
Is it a race?
Yeah, it's a race. So it's basically rallying on the road. I think there's now, I could be wrong, so somebody will should be down for this. I think there's a max speed limit now of 200K because there's probably a few too many interesting crashes.
Yeah.
But, you know, like all sorts of machines would go in it. I've had friends have gone in it. So you have your Porsches, your Yaris's, your Mustangs, your all sorts of things.
Yeah, it looks like a cool event because the scenery is like unbelievable. And then is that one of the bigger, what are the sort of big events around? Are there many things to go to?
Yeah. There's all sorts of, at the major racetracks, there'll be all sorts of events. The V8 supercars come across from Australia. That's always been a big draw card, that one. Various different, motorsport events. Tend to be clustered around types of cars. So, for instance, there's a big rotary scene here. So, there's a whole group of people who really love their rotaries. So, you know, Mad Mike Woodit, who everybody's heard about. Yeah, he's based up in Auckland. So, I can't remember the festival, but you know, all the rotor heads will be up there on Hampton Downs on weekends. So, and there's a lot of the town we moved to, was just a surprising amount of weekend events like Cars and Coffee. And we'll have probably the town's about 50 odd thousand people, and the Cars and Coffee will probably be 100 ish gallons.
Quite a lot.
Yeah. So it seems this particular place, it seems to be where everybody sort of retires with their cars, and there'll be hot rods and there'll be Porsches and Ferraris and all sorts. It's just an amazing eclectic bunch of cars here.
Yeah. When you got in touch with me, I think you'd been looking at Ultimas. I don't know, as like a sort of, I guess that's taking the sort of bespoke build. Is the bespoke build part of it a huge part of it for you?
Yeah,
well, is that a huge part of the interest?
Yeah, the bespoke build. I mean, the reason I got the Fraser was, you know, what's the nearest I can get to supercar territory without supercar money?
And
and just basically reduce the weight down to nothing and put as much horsepower in it as possible. and hang on, it's surprisingly controllable. Like they are incredibly controllable machines. Like the event of it, just before I went on the startup journey, I had an RS7 Performance, which, you know, it was a big executive car and very quick off the line and good acceleration, but it's not dramatic.
No. There's something about heavy performance that is just like, meh. Like I have E63S Estate. It's a silly car. And about a week after I bought it, I was like, this is kind of silly. Because it's nearly two, I think it's like 2 tons, a little bit less than 2 tons, somewhere around there. It's got 600 and something horsepower or whatever. And you're like, it's objectively very quick. But it's not fun. Like, it doesn't give you any fizz, anything. There's so much mass. Whereas when you go the other end of the spectrum, and go down to 5, 6, whatever, 100 kilos. It's just a completely different experience to driving anything, even like over a ton or 1500. Like, it's so different, isn't it?
Yeah, and that was the difference between the Fraser and the RS7, right? The RS7 was 600 horsepower, and you know, again, I think they were 2200 kilos. And the only way you could realistically have serious fun in it is on a wet road, traction control off or stability control off, which then it might be a bit more interesting. But, you know, you're throwing around a serious amount of metal.
And it takes a lot to stop that. Once it started going in a direction, you're aware that, like, oh, hang on, there's a lot of mass.
Yeah. And it sounded good, and it was great when, you know, for the quote-unquote executive car, you've had a long day at work and you just want something to drive home in. And whereas the Fraser, like, you go out and it's absolutely electric. You come back and you're like, well, it was just an assault on the senses. So, you know, I'm going to get in trouble with my wife with it when she listens to this, but, the next... Because it's like, no more after the Fraser. No more.
You're like, no, I want more crazy. That's what I want. I want more, just more crazy. You sent me a video before this of you have a sim, and I've got a sim that's behind this wall behind me. But you've built like a... Explain this. Is it a G seat? So does it shake? How does this work? And why did you build your own moving seat?
Okay, all right. So what was it? A number of years ago, I had a simulator, as a lot of people do, and you get you have your simulator journey of you have your little plastic wheel, and then you go, okay, you go get a direct drive wheel, and you've gone that step. So
I've now gone that step.
Yeah. So you get your direct drive wheel and you're like, wow, this is actually, hang on, that's quite impressive. Like the feedback you get through the wheel of what's happened with the car. And then I came across this DIY actuator design of a vertical actuator to lift the, do the movement up and down and tilting left, right, forward, backwards off a platform. So, okay. And it was quite cool because you go, and so at the time you had the $40,000 D-Box route of going and getting the D-Box actuators, and there was a couple other DIY ones that weren't that good, but this one came out called the SFX100, which, okay, you go buy a 3D printer, you 3D print the mounts for the servos to the ball screws and extrusions, buy all these parts from China, and you put it together and it's like $3,000 and you've got these high performance actuators.
Okay.
And the thing, like literally it will lift like your complete simulator weight with you in it is and I'm not a big guy, sorry. About 200 kilos probably. And it will lift it off the ground. Like we go there's one particular part on the ring, depending on the sim title you're on, because I think you're about 250 millimeters a second vertical speed in these actuators. And right. It literally jump the rig off the ground and walk it. <you know? laughs> Which, you have to have it on concrete and it's awesome. So I built that and that was awesome. And then, of course, you want more. So you start looking around at what can you do more. And I'd seen a couple of designs for G-seats. Now, they're not simulating G-forces, but they're tricking your brain into what's happening. So you turn right.
Yeah.
And on a real car, you turn right and G-forces are pushing you left into the seat, right? Yeah. So you get what's actually happening is you're not necessarily feeling the G-forces. You're feeling the pressure on your left side into the seat. That's what you're really feeling.
Yeah.
Because you can't feel this imaginary force passing across you. So
yeah, you're getting pushed from that side, the left or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's been a couple around that there's one in UK, Cranfield Simulations. It's kind of more of a professional motorsport simulations, and they've got airbag type system in the seat, so pneumatic bags that create that pressure. And there was another one, I can't remember the name, but I actually tried it out and it had little panels probably about 3 inches by 2 inches on your back, just trying to simulate some of that pressure. I was like, well, that's terrible. I tried it out. It was awful and it sounded.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Noisy and...
Yeah.
And this was the time when I was working sort of a corporate job and I needed some release from my build side of the brain. So I just started prototyping things and ended up prototyping this G-seat that was four independent movable panels that had these big servos that would control them and use these industrial servos off CNC machines.
Okay. At one point, I guess the travel in all of these is like, you're not just suddenly going to take like a massive hit to the kidneys from this one of these servos at one point in time.
Well, yeah, I actually had to dial back in the software and the settings because it did actually get a bit too quick at one point. And you're like, oh, this could actually hurt because the speed at which, because they're, I mean, it basically geared off a pulley that would, well, the servo would go into a pulley and push an arm that would push the flap of the seat.
Yeah.
So it's quick. And so normal, like when you're going around, say, Bathurst and, you know, going up through Skyline in the car, you'll feel that movement of the car kind of almost hopping sideways on the track as you'll feel all that through the panel. But the trick is tuning the speed of that. And when you actually hit the wall and there's a sudden movement, you don't want that sudden movement to actually break something.
Yeah. That's it. It's like, I remember when people turn up, like my direct drive is quite a cheap one. So it's not that powerful, but still I wouldn't want to like fully cranked and then hit something. But with like the really beefy ones, you get that thing of like, genuinely, you could break your wrists if you like mess around with this. Like, no thanks.
Yeah, and I think some people have. I think I've seen on the odd forum of people with like broken fingers or a broken wrist from it.
So totally. If you wrapped your hand through a wheel and then it gave it full beans in one direction, or you went one way then the other, nasty. So you built this seat. Like, when you built this and you got, how does it interface with the software? Like, is the software quite good at telling it what to do? Like, how does it know where to move and what to do to make it feel right?
Yeah, so what the simulator games or racing titles have is they have a feed of information that's coming out of them that's the actual real world, well, not real world, but virtual world.
Yeah.
Telemetry of the car. So, you know, what its angle, you know, roll, pitch, yaw, and what the G-forces are that's happening. Coming out. So as the car is going up and down, you know, it goes over a bump, there'll be a spike in the G-forces, the vertical G-forces. And the tracks are all laser scanned. So they are incredibly detailed. You can tell if you're hitting a regular curb versus a sausage curb. I think Hungaroring, there's like, as you come on to the start finish straight, you can tell there's a hollow as you come off the curb right at the exit of the corner. There's a hollow there because you can feel it.
Yeah.
So all this telemetry is coming out, and then a couple of clever people have written software that takes that telemetry and allows you to convert it into movement of the actuators. So, you know, hey, if you get if you get a spike of some G's going, you know, some negative or positive G's laterally, then that translates into some movement of the servo that's controlling the flap with a whole bunch of settings around it with decay curves and all sorts of wizardry going on inside there.
Interesting. So you had the first setup. And the first setup, what did the before you had the seat moving and all that sort of stuff, did the first setup just move all four corners?
So the you'll have the kind of roll and pitch of the car. So as you brake and the car nose dives forward, and as accelerate pulls back, and the heave as it's going over bumps and curves and that. So it's pretty detailed.
And with that setup, did you feel like it was like another step in the involvement of driving the car, or were you like, this is all right, but I'm not that bothered?
It's layers of immersion, right? Like that was definitely this is awesome. And I think this was just before the pandemic. So, you know, everybody, you're sitting there and you're starting to think about things, what to do, and you know, can this be made better? Right. Yeah. What is missing?
Because
I think that's right. At that point, I'd gotten so busy with the day job, it had just meant that track time was out of the picture. I couldn't go down to the track with the car. So, you know, that was my outlet at home was that. So
100%. That has happened to me with having a toddler. Like, I just don't really have time at the moment, like weekends and whatever, to just go Got on track days and stuff. So my sim has been a great investment. I've not leveled it up that much recently. I think I've sort of hit a point where I'm like, yeah, it's all right. I don't, without any home build motion. So this machine that you've now built, how much would it cost? The sort of commercial / public ones you can go and buy of this sort of thing. Is there anything that moves in a similar way to yours? Or are they just these, I've heard of the ones that are like kind of pressure, where they kind of like push you a little bit in different sides and stuff.
Yeah, there is only two, so the general platform, so the moving the vertical up, down,
yeah,
there's a bunch of systems on the market, sort of ranging £3,000 to £5,000 for the actuators, up to 30,000-40,000 pounds for a complete rig, all set up. You know, here you go. Don't have to think about it. Just jump in and use it. And then the GC, I don't know now. I haven't paid attention in the last couple of years. Certainly at the time I built it, there was only the pressure-based ones, and they're still pretty expensive. Like, it was, in relative terms, I think, the only commercial GC at the time, it runs at $5,000 US. I tried it out and it was just sort of noisy and wasn't that good.
Not that great. And if someone wanted to build one of these, do you have like a tracking of like what you did?
Oh yeah, like, I actually open sourced the plan. So I designed the whole lot. So I did, there was multiple evolutions to get to where I got to. And then I just said, okay, well, here's the Fusion 360 files. Like, it's all CNC break, cut and break folded aluminium for seat design. And okay, here's the polys, et cetera, you need. I don't know if anybody's built one. Maybe somebody's built one.
If someone had built one, I feel like they might tell you.
I hope so.
I think they would. I think they'd be like, hey, I built one. I built it. This is great. And so a question that I think probably gets asked, this is, I get for you, is I'm sure is all about immersion. It's about making it like a more fun experience. Do you think it makes you faster?
Wow.
Or one that something people sometimes say is like, do you think you have less spins and things because of that? That's sometimes the other.
I've never done back-to-back of, hey, am I faster on on this track versus off? If you turn it all off, it's like, oh, okay, this is a bit boring. since the startup and moving houses, I haven't had it back running again. In its full glory. Like, I've had it with just the wheel. I'm like, oh, okay, right.
It
just doesn't have the same appeal anymore. Like, once you try it out, you're like, oh, this is awesome. I really want to use this. So it's actually probably a good thing, because otherwise I'd probably spend a few too many hours on that versus working on the startup. So.
And do you think that was run on Assetto Corsa? Or Assetto Corsa competition or something like that?
Yeah, ACC, so Competizione, is it had, in my view, the best modeling of car dynamics.
That's the best racing game I think I've played in terms of like how stuff feels, I think. So with Global Workshop, how do you see it sort of progressing? What's the, like, do you think it's going to go into a different avenue with some different usages, or expand lots of the back end? What are some of the like things you would like to see in there, or a usage that you'd not necessarily thought of, but it's going to get a lot of usage for, or maybe even at the moment?
Yeah, so we've got a huge roadmap of things we unveiled. So we started from media, then added in parts and inventory management and time tracking, and as the types of clients we've been bringing on, we've actually gotten closer and closer to bespoke production type things. So we've actually got a couple of track toy companies now, which is quite exciting.
Okay. Cool.
And marine worlds and boat builders. The next thing we're about to launch is a full I'm calling that constructed edition, bill of material plan for a vehicle. So you can go plan out, like, hey, here's the chassis inside the chassis. We're going to make a tub inside the tub. We're going to need so many meters of X12 carbon and so much resin and all this, and all those materials required. So we've got a number of companies that are eagerly waiting that one. We've been compared against 25 different ERP systems. One of our boat building clients had, they sort of talked us into it. So I was never ever going to go down this path. And so that's insane and complicated, because we sort of experienced from the window and door world, like bill of materials management is complex. And they kept twisting our arm going, Ryan, come on, you can do it. You can do it. We've looked at all these other software. We like what you're doing on the front end. You got to do the bomb plan. We have to do the bomb plan. Come on, you can do it. Okay, all right. So that was about 10 months ago, twisted our arm, and we're now very, very close to launching that, which is exciting, because there's, from what we can tell, there's nothing on the planet that does that. And particularly the bespoke world, because you'll go, okay, here's a vehicle, and then the owner wants this particular cowhide from this cow up in the Swiss Alps somewhere for their interior. So you need to swap out that and change this, and these things that you'll be, you don't know ahead of time, but you need to have in your final build cost. So we're doing things that kind of the nearest equivalent would be ERP systems that they're not doing, which is quite exciting.
Yeah.
And then also about to bring out lifing, so component lifing, which you probably have some experience with in the motorsport world.
Yeah.
So, you know, traditional vehicles, you keep track of the overall vehicle mileage, but not really keeping track of shock has done, what this brake disc has done, you know, how many hours were on the engine, when do we need to go and replace the diff oil, when was that last done? And so we can actually track all of that and have it all app-based. So one of the key things for us is various functions are out on the app. So, for instance, the owner of that car, he might go on an arrive and drive program, who just turns up at the racetrack, goes, drives it, and then comes back home. We can see on the app, oh, heck, I'm going to have a service bill coming out shortly for, you know, my shocks are just about done. So I can see what's about to happen on the car. And
that would be so good. That would be so good. Because I've not thought about it from a motorsport point of view, but I've had that, like, the team, and depending on how good your team is, it will depend on how much they track all of these sorts of things, but my team were pretty good at it, but I had no real idea. Like, I know you've got a new set of brake discs, you've got to do XYZ, like, you know, from a driving point of view and things like that, but yeah, like, I would love that on all my cars, everything, like, literally I want to track everything because it matters, as you say.
Yeah, and that's sort of our ethos, is we're tracking as much as humanly possible about a machine. There's around 9 years ago, there was a video by Chris Harris and Max Gerardo, and they talked about a Jag XJR9. Chris Harris went around and drove it, and they talked about this machine, and this was sort of a pivotal moment for me. It's like, it talked about, you know, hey, I can't remember the words, but Chris Harris says, you know, talk about some people are ultimate car nerds and track everything that goes on in a car and they document it. And then Max goes and brings out this massive stack of paperwork. Yeah. It's like this high of bound A4 PDFs of everything about that car history. And somebody at that race team had been meticulously, and they would have spent an enormous amount of effort to document that.
Yeah.
Absolutely enormous. And so, and that's what everybody actually wants. They want that for their cars, right?
Yeah.
that level of tracking. And so we're building it up as things happen on the car natively, right? So as people are scanning out stuff from stores and saying, okay, well, we need some old brake pads on it. as it's recorded, it's gone to this event. Now we've recorded that on that part, that part's been at that event. And so when the lifing comes out, hey, you know, now that's done 500 miles this weekend and so many hours, and that's due for service, and then somebody's serviced it, somebody's replaced it. It's all recorded there for each individual part on the kinner, so that hey, if that car ever goes to change hands, here's all the entire history of the machine. You know exactly what happened everywhere, which is sort of the holy grail for those machines.
Because having a big stack of documents is really cool. Like it's really nice, but at the same time, it's not searchable at all in any way, shape, or form. It's like, right, somewhere in there is, okay, depending on how you organize it and whatever, but you've got to go through all these invoices, all this stuff, what's done at what time. So if you're starting to add this functionality in, does the interface start to get like insanely complicated? Or have you, how does that work?
No, it depends on who's doing what in the system. Right. So, for instance, on the lifing side, it's pretty simple from the people who will be, you know, the techs at the track or the owner to go, okay, well, there's now going to be a new tab in the app beside parts tab, lifing tab. So tap on the lifing tab and okay, here's all the parts that are lifed and add a log back, nice and simple. And then the people in the office, you know, they're having a, today, they, if they're doing it, they're having to do that in a spreadsheet. So they have to manually go in and update a spreadsheet, and it's just tedious. So they don't. Well, you know, someone will do it well, some of them won't. So this is much simpler for them to manage that in the web interface. They can go, okay, all right, here's my cars. You know, and it'll bring up the alerts on the cars to go, hey, these things have now tripped their service life, right? They haven't had to go through and look through some spreadsheets to go, oh, okay, now it's got to go replace this.
Do a bit of conditional formatting.
It'll alert them when things go wrong and things need to be done. So that's feedback we get that, hey, it is quite intuitive for people to get
out. That's pretty cool if you've got, someone running your car. What if you're just an individual? Is it possible, like if I wanted to track my cars, is that sort of possible?
It is possible. We'll set up an account for people. We haven't, and I think that's kind of where we started this from. I thought this would come from the individual angle. In reality, and there have been some attempts along those lines for tracking people's own car collection. Well, there's various apps out there.
There's a few websites and whatnot,
And I think there's only the hardened few that will go and enter everything about their cars and keep it up to date. And certainly marketing to that group and getting that group to spend money is...
It's not a lot of people.
No. No. There's been a lot of people who've tried to crack that. They really tried to crack that and some really good attempts. But they've probably blown millions of dollars in the process and out there, their end game idea. Oops.
From a business point of view, I think it just makes a lot more sense to be doing the businesses rather than the individuals. But like, I've got a friend, he just has uses a bespoke Excel document that he's created over like a long time to track a lot of cars.
Those people can go and look at our website and sign up. So that's not a problem. I'm just a car nerd as well, and I didn't necessarily want to go after the general market because I like the machines that are on the platform. Yeah. Like we've got one of my hero cars, like Ayrton Senna's 98T, actually sat in it. Nice. The 1980s. it's amazing. Patrick Morgan, a Dawn trader, is on the platform using it. And so, you know, you've got these machines and they're not managed by the individuals, right? They're managed by the shops. The shops are managing them. So, high net worth of individuals aren't sitting there and tracking their own car collections. So
that is quite interesting. So you can see all this stuff. Yeah, that's cool.
Well, you become friends with all with the owners of these shops. Like, we went on a shop tour last September. So what's fascinating in my little journey on this is, so we had some businesses on the platform. We originally had the first crack at starting about 10 years ago. I was just too early. And then 2.5 years ago, it was about the time I was thinking, okay, my corporate job, I was kind of coming to the end of the road. I was done with it. I wanted to do something different, not quite as stressful. And Rick, talking to all our businesses, and they're like, oh, we'll introduce you to so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. So I went for my first trip to the UK, really didn't have a lot of businesses to visit. Suddenly by the end of the trip, it was crazy, and we're visiting lots. In September last year, went back for bookended a trip, went to Le Mans Classic, bookended with Goodwood, and had shops all the way in between. Visited 22 shops in 8 days.
Wow. That's quite a lot.
And it was just epic, the amount of machines I managed to see and the doors that were open. And every time you went into a business, it was like, oh, do you want to see the cards? Well, of course.
Yeah, that's why I'm here, yes.
Oh, okay, now we'll sell you some software afterwards.
We've got these updates, thank you very much.
Yeah. It's the awesome thing in being in this industry is everybody's knows each other. The machines are awesome, the people are great. So,
does that excite you the most about this whole project? Just like what the resultant out the other end is?
Yeah, it's equal parts. I have built this thing and I'm really proud of it. And it's kind of incredible. It's because I'm very much a builder, and in my previous roles, I'd sort of gotten up to the joint CEO, MD type roles, which get further and further and further away from hands-on. Yeah. And so this has been very much hands-on building. So I'm the lead engineer behind it. We've got some other software developers. So I spend a lot of my day coding. So one hand, it's like, oh, hey, here's this awesome thing to build. And on the other hand, it's just like the quotes and testimonials and things we get from people is just off the charts. Like companies, you go visit and you think, oh, we're never getting even be allowed to say we visited that company, let alone now we've got a testimonial on the website or a quote and some photos. It's just incredible.
That's awesome. That is so cool. I normally wrap up my podcast with 5 questions. So let's do the 5 questions. Do you have a most memorable driving trip or journey? Was it that one visiting all the shops? or do you have another most memorable?
Yes, it was very memorable. But going to Le Mans Classic was, that's like an epic, and it was the 100th of it. So I've become good friends with Cal at Retro Power, and Carolyn became my UK agent. So we all hopped in an RV and went to Le Mans Classic. And along the way, I'm editing a video because we just got our testimonial video brought in by a video guy back in New Zealand. So we're editing that and going backwards and forwards on that with him. And, these cars just keep passing us along the way, GT40, Cobra, Porsche, GT40. You just kind of feel this anticipation as you get closer and closer to crossing the tunnel. And then on the other side is just epic machine after epic machine. Yeah. So it's kind of excitement building the whole way. That was something else. So it's definitely a memorable one.
Very, That is such a sick event.
Like, oh,
just unbelievable.
235,000 people.
That's
across
a lot.
Yeah, across that 4 days. And because did you go?
I didn't go to the most recent one. I went to the one before. So whenever that was, 6 years ago, maybe. I can't remember when the last one was. Is it every 4 or is it every 2?
I think it's every 2. Could be wrong. That one was special because it was the centennial and it was also the 75th Porsche celebrations. It's like 9,000 display cars. 9,000. It's just fields of cars. You just didn't know where to look.
Yeah. If you could only drive one car for the rest of your life, a sports car, what would it be?
Okay. I'm going to go with, I haven't driven it, but I am going to put the Ultimate I'm going to put the Ultimate GTR out there. Oh, they're going to kill me for this one, but I'd take the V8 out, and if it was the one car for rest of life, I'd put a quad rotor in. As close as you can get to a 787 on the road, that would be it. It would sound absolutely epic. They've made them reliable. And it would be an event every single time you got in the car.
Yes, it would. It would. What do you think is the most undervalued car at the moment? What should be worth more?
That's a hard question. I've got the Geo Yaris, and that's surprisingly a lot of car for what it costs. I believe the rumor is that it costs almost doubled to make it from when, because they were all hand built, right? Like
I don't actually know. I feel like maybe by the end of production, no. Because they're doing another round of them, and I don't think they would have done another 15,000 or whatever it is if they were losing money on the second lot. But then when you look at like the whole project costs, that always gets interesting, doesn't it? When you look at, there's so many cars, like all like Bugattis and whatever, that you hear that are like, actually they cost 5 million each or something like that.
I was just, like, there's little things on the car that you don't realize. And like the forged carbon roof, it's got a little fake vinyl on it.
Why does it have vinyl on it?
why did they do that? They're trying to somehow diminish the value of the car. And then there's this beautiful forged carbon roof on the top. I don't know. I don't follow the modern stuff as closely, so that's probably not a great answer to the question. But
I think that's a good answer.
I think the original GIRS will hold its value really well. The Corolla and the new one, oh, I had a look at the interior on the release photos. I was like, whoa.
It's like a big box.
Yeah, I don't know. The design is... It's kind of the appeal of the GIRS, the original one, and it's like, okay, it's like a Crawler inside, right? It's not trying to be anything fancy inside. It's like they just built this thing to go racing and made it good enough for the road out of the parts bin. That it's like, okay, that's the appeal of it. But as soon as you start trying to put design in it with that funky dash that got on the new one,
I actually thought that was just like a prototype dash in a development car when I saw it. Like, genuinely, is that what the dash is like? It's like this big TV, old school TV, like.
Oh, I hope not.
It's pretty grim.
Well, it's sort of, it has some design cues of the. So we've got an FJ Cruiser, right? The new the newer style thing, and it's got this massive dash area, big and chunky, and it's all outlandish. And so they've kind of almost put some of that outlandish element in the new one. So don't necessarily agree with what they've done there.
I'll see. Oh, okay. I'm looking at photos. It's possibly not quite as bad as what I saw. I'd be interested to see what it looks like in real life. It's quite odd. It's a bit odd. It's quite driver focused.
Yeah. It's function. It's definitely function over form.
And they seem to have like taken a lot of general feedback and stuff on the car and adapted it. So like the seat's a bit lower and they changed the suspension a little bit and the engines possibly don't blow up and those sorts of things. No, it's a fun car, that. Most interesting car to you at the moment? What are you Googling? What are you looking at?
So most interesting is this little project out of Australia. It's called a Hyper Racer.
X1. Okay.
Yeah. And so this one to me is very interesting, and I'd probably have this in my garage if I could. It is a little formula car. That's powered by motorbike engine, big aero on it. It is ridiculous. It is. So the thing will pull, I think it's about 2.8G laterally, okay, and 3G deceleration.
Whoa.
It is, in my viewpoint, the ultimate go to the track with your mate's track toy. If you can convince a bunch of your mates to buy them, which I think is probably happening a lot. Like I say, I think they've got about 20 now in a series in Australia.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, that's very good. How much do they cost?
I don't know off the top of my head. I think I've seen a quotient figure out there, and I don't want to say it because it might be wrong. it's relatively cheap, and its running costs, because it's all bike engine and lightweight, like it's 400 kilos, just under 400 kilos. So your running costs per track session are cheap as chips, right?
Yeah.
Like, could be hundreds of pounds, not thousands and thousands of pounds every time you go to the track. So you can just trailer it to the track, go nuts with your mates.
Go very fast.
And, you know, with the aero, I think it'd be a challenge car to drive. Like, you'd have to build up your skills driving it. You can't just go and drive it,
set an awesome record,
go home. So that's one I'm watching. I'm hoping they're going to become a client of ours soon enough.
Every then time you can be like, hey, we've got to come see you. I think you're probably going to let me drive one. I've never come across that. So, you know, thanks for introducing me to another little mad.
Yeah, that one would be so much fun. And I've watched a video of like people getting out of it and just their heads, their sores, their necks, because they're just used to the G loading on it. So, yes, I definitely want one of those.
Right. Okay. Final question. 5-car garage, unlimited value.
Okay, so we've got a couple of dogs, and in the other garage, I'm going to have a GP hydroplane, because this is just the car's garage. So in the other garage, I'm going to have a big boat, fast boat. So I need a Land Cruiser, but I get like a 6x6 conversion, because you need to tow the big boat.
Right. Fair enough.
So I get my mates over at Retro Powder to build that for me, because they're doing an epic job on that. Builds. Yep. I'd get that Ultimate GTR out of the cockroach, because, you know, why wouldn't you? Just scare yourself on a Sunday going to the shops. I'd keep the GRRs, because that is such a fun little car, and it's just not pretentious.
Yeah.
Right. Like, nobody's looking at you. You just can go around 100%.
You're just in a little like granny wagon, except it's badass.
Yeah. And my other half loves driving it, and she loves it. So, yeah, everybody's happy.
Yep.
And then one of the hero cars I met on one of the trips, this will test your knowledge, a TR Speed 12 Turbo.
Oh, TVR Speed 12. Yeah, there was like one of them. Was there one?
Yeah, so there was two, I think there was two TVR Speed 12s built. And then a whole bunch of the TVR engineers went off to another company, Helical Technologies, I think. They do like tier one OEM type stuff, exhaust valves and all that kind of thing. So it's got this like fully muscular.
Yeah.
Yeah. Proper British supercar, front engine, rear wheel drive. What are they? 6 liter.
Six-liter V12
twin turbo,
1,000 horsepower. Yeah, that fits your turbo need.
So how many was that? Was that four or five?
That's four. Four more.
Oh yes, and so we need the very very fancy car that you can just go to an event with your other half in, go out to dinner, etc. And that's got to be the Eagle Low Drag GT.
Oh yeah.
Just beautiful machines.
Have you got them on your platform yet?
Yeah. Yeah. I've had the good fortune of meeting them, and they're just incredible looking machines. So the Low Drag in particular, to me, is just outstanding design. So and might have half be happy going to dinner and that very much.
Nice.
So. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. I'd have one of them.
Yeah.
Very cool. Right, well, there we go. five cars. Thanks very much for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.